Charles, let me talk to you. I'm talking with Charles Ramsey. He's a neighbor. Walk me through again what happened this afternoon. You heard screaming.
Heard screaming. I meet my McDonald's. I come outside. I see this girl going nuts, trying to get out of her house. So I go on the porch. And she says, "Help me get out. I've been in here a long time." So, you know, I figured it's a domestic violence dispute. So I open the door. We can't get in that way because how the door is, it's so much that a body can't fit through, only your hand. So we could kick the bottom. And she comes out with the little girl, and she says, "Call 911. My name is Amanda Berry."
Did you know who that was when she said that?
When she told me, it didn't register until I got to call the 911. And now I'm like, I'm calling the 911 for Amanda Berry. I thought this girl was dead. You know what I mean? And she got on the phone and she said, "Yes, this is me." And the detective Gregory Cook says, "Charles, do you know who you rescued?"
I said, "Now, and when did you see? When did you see Gina?"
About 5 minutes after the police got here. See, that girl Amanda told the police, "I ain't just the only ones. It's some more girls up in that house." So they went up there, you know, 30, 40 deep. And when they came out, it was just astonishing because I thought they were going to come up with nothing. I figured, I mean, whoever she was, and like I said, my neighbor, you got some big testicles to pull this off, bro. Because we see this dude every day. I mean, every day.
How long have you lived here?
I've been here a year.
Okay.
You sure coming from?
Right.
I barbecue with this dude. We eat ribs and whatnot and listen to salsa music. You sure coming from?
You had no indication that there's anything.
Bro, not a clue that girl was in that house or anybody else was in there against their will. Because how he is he just comes out to his backyard, plays with the dogs, tinker with his cars and motorcycles, goes back in the house. So he's somebody that you look and you look away because he's not doing nothing but the average stuff. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Nothing exciting about him. Well, until today.
What was your reaction on the girls' faces? I can't imagine to see the sunlight to be real.
I knew something was wrong when a little pretty white girl ran into a black man's arms. Something is wrong here. Dead giveaway.
Charles, thank you very much.
Dead giveaway.
Thank you very much for your time.
Either she homeless or she got problems. That's the only reason why she ran into a black man.
Charles, thank you for being there, man. Charles Ramsey, neighbor, heard the screaming, took action, went and did what he needed to do. The rest is unfolding before us here on scene. We're going to send it back to you.
Hi, welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. This is the new year, our first podcast of the new year.
2017.
You got it.
Yep. So today's story is the story of three girls who in 2 years went missing from the same street. Now, Michelle Knight, 21 years old, was kidnapped in August of 2002. Amanda Berry, almost 17 years old, was kidnapped in April of 2003. And Gina DeJesus, only 14, was kidnapped in April of 2004. Until May 2013, they were held captive in the home of a sadistic man. Now, this is an extraordinary story of sadness and horror, but also of strength and survival. The three young victims endured more than I could ever imagine. So with our discussion, in addition to learning about the deranged mind behind the crimes, I hope to honor the strength of these women. Also, as you heard in our lead-in, there was a widespread joy when they broke free of their hellish captivity. Charles Ramsey, now he was a neighbor on the street they were in, and he was interviewed shortly after the girls were freed, and he really summed up the neighborhood's excited reaction for me. So we have a lot to talk about with this case, beginning way back in the perpetrator's childhood in Puerto Rico. So no time to waste. I'm going to read the 5-star reviews, and then Dick will introduce the beer.
I got a good beer today.
I'm glad. Okay, so I'm going to read some 5-star reviews. And the first one is Working While Listening by Little Miss Vixen. She says, "My supervisor at work recently found this podcast and told me I have to give it a try. I love it. We both are currently binge listening all day at work and have to stop every so often to talk about the cases. Love the interaction between Jill and Dick. They are a breath of fresh air compared to other podcast hosts. I truly appreciate the time and research they put into every case. Keep up the good work."
Great review. Just one little thing. I hope they're not doing neurosurgery while they're listening to the podcast.
Yeah, hopefully it's something that they can listen and still do their job without killing anyone.
Absolutely.
Okay, so Little Miss Vixen, Little Miss Vixen and Little Miss Vixen's supervisor, welcome to the brewery.
Come on down to the quiet end with us.
Now, another one is Simply Wonderful by Olivia 0005. And Olivia says, this podcast is simply wonderful. Dick's beer reviews are music to my ears, and these two tell the story of a crime like no one else. Thank you, Jill and Dick. Thank you, Olivia, and welcome to the brewery.
That's a good review. Thank you.
Yeah. And another one is The Future of Driving. I've been listening to True Crime Brewery for about 6 months now, and when I found TCB, I listened to every episode I could as fast as possible. Instantly hooked to the storytelling and playfulness between Jill and Dick. True Crime Brewery has quickly become a routine in my week. I often listen to podcasts while I'm doing things like the dishes. I can relate, I do the same thing.
Yes, that sounds familiar.
And TCB is always the first I go to, hoping for the new episode. I love it so much that once I got so mad at myself for watching a Dateline episode on TV, only to realize that TCB was covering the exact same case, which meant I wouldn't get to listen to my beloved podcast the same that week. It's about time I really wrote a 5-star review, as well as joined Team Tie Grabber. I had to get that snifter that Dickie is always using. Can hardly wait to get it in the mail. Thank you, Jill and Dick, for making my week every week. I'll see you both at the quiet end of the bar, Madeline.
Well, Madeline, that is making our day.
Yeah, it was a little lengthy, but it was nice. So, welcome to the brewery, Madeline.
And we will definitely save you a seat at the quiet end.
Absolutely. Now you can go ahead and tell us about your beer.
I have a beer from Ohio. I was trying to find something brewed in Cleveland, but I didn't. This is from Columbus. It's Columbus Bodhi. I think that's the correct pronunciation. B-O-D-H-I. It's a double IPA from Columbus Brewing Company. And this is an American double or imperial IPA, which I think I drank last week. So just for those who can't remember from week to week, like me.
I don't either, actually.
A DIPA is an IPA on steroids. So it tends to be more alcoholic, more hoppy, more in-your-face aggressiveness. This one, Bodhi, is a clear gold color with a small white head that still leaves some patchy lace. Kind of pretty. It has a pine and herbal and citrus aroma. Really great aroma. And the aroma translates well into the taste. So we get some citrus, grapefruit, some herbs, very herbal, and a lot of pine.
I don't know if I like a lot of pine in my beer.
Oh, it's like you're in a forest. It's great.
Yeah. If you like forests, I guess.
This is a medium to full-bodied beer. The alcohol is there, but not too noticeable. So I highly recommend it.
Okay. Well, let's open it up and head on down to the quiet end.
Okay.
Okay, Dickie, are you ready to head on down to that quiet end of the bar?
I'm ready. I'm noticing that there are just a lot of guys here tonight, but not many women.
Is there football on or something tonight?
No. Season's over. Playoffs start next weekend.
I bet I know why. Because The Bachelor. The Bachelor's starting tonight.
And?
Well, I think a lot of women like to watch The Bachelor.
Oh, my God.
It's my guilty pleasure.
So we get to watch 25 or so women degrade themselves, all in the hopes of getting some idiot loser to propose to them.
Well, the men do it to propose to a woman, so I think it goes both ways. And it's fun to watch.
Yeah, sort of like a train wreck is fun to watch.
Yeah, or a car accident.
Yeah.
Yeah, I enjoy it. And it's Nick that's the Bachelor. He's been a 2-time loser on The Bachelor.
Nick's the guy that's been shot down twice already.
Yeah.
If I recall.
That's right.
I've done extensive research on Nick.
I know you spend a lot of time thinking about The Bachelor.
I do. So, good luck this season, Nikki.
Yeah. So, let's do this podcast so we can get home and watch it. I've got it on the DVR.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. I know you'd like that.
I'm going to be eating some dinner and stuff.
Okay. So, let's get to our case.
All right. This is a horrific case.
It's a horrific case, but it has kind of a happy ending, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So the monster who kidnapped Michelle, Amanda, and Gina, he was born in 1960 in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Now, his father had two families in the same neighborhood, and he had nine siblings in total. When his parents divorced, Castro moved to the U.S., and he lived with his mother and three of his siblings. First, they settled in Reading, Pennsylvania, and later they moved to Cleveland, where his extended family members lived. Now, he graduated high school in 1979 as an average student, but he did have one thing he was really good at. He played the bass guitar very well, and he got a lot of gigs with salsa bands.
He apparently was quite well known in the Midwest for his guitar playing.
Yeah, I think if his personality hadn't sucked so badly, he would have been more successful.
Yes.
He was difficult to work with.
He had a shitty personality.
Absolutely. That's putting it mildly.
Yeah.
So he met his girlfriend, Grimilda Figueroa, in the 1980s. They moved into the home at 2207 Seymour Avenue in 1992. And that house was a two-story house. It was 1,400 square feet. It had four bedrooms and one bathroom and an unfinished basement. Now, Grimilda's mother knew Castro's mother, and she approved of the relationship in the beginning.
Yeah, he was older than her by several years, wasn't he?
Not as much as with the other girlfriend later on. He was a lot older then.
Right, but right. He was still, I mean, Grimilda or Melda or whatever they called her, she was like 17 when they started dating, right?
I'm not sure about that.
I think she's pretty young.
Yeah, I'm sure she was young. Now, she was impressed with the way he was well-dressed and that he was a musician, and he treated her well and took her out to expensive restaurants. And she actually lost her virginity to him one night when they were parked on the banks of Lake Erie. So when Castro brought Grimilda home in the wee hours, her mother confronted him, and she said that he needed to take her from her home to live with him now that they'd had sex together.
That's a very Catholic viewpoint, isn't it?
Yeah. Old school.
Yep.
And they had their first child, Ariel Castro Jr., in 1981. So Castro became very controlling after that and started abusing Grimilda. And Grimilda was frequently bruised from her husband's attacks. He broke her nose. He also instituted some strict, weird rules in the house. She wasn't allowed to leave the apartment without his permission.
Now, he did more than just abuse her. I mean, he inflicted her horrible
punishment. He beat the hell out of her.
He used her as a punching bag. He kicked her. He threw her downstairs.
Yeah, really awful.
And the thing is, and I know you're going to talk about this.
Yeah.
It went unreported.
When it
did get reported, she refused to press charges.
Right.
And that's just foreign to me.
But yeah.
I know.
Well, they had some old school values going on in that community.
There's reasons for doing what she did, but still.
Yeah. She wasn't allowed to really go out much, and if she did go out, she had to wear these long, dowdy dresses because he didn't want other men to look at her. Yeah. So
yeah.
That's a bad sign.
For sure.
Okay.
I mean, there's all sorts of warning signs.
And well, sure.
Here she is getting the shit beaten out of her.
Yeah.
And he's got all these weird rules and regulations.
Yeah.
Which she agreed to, or acquiesced to. Maybe she didn't agree.
Well, come on. She really didn't have much choice considering her situation. I don't think her English was even fluent, so she had limited availability of escape. So Castro even controlled where she would do her grocery shopping and what she could buy, and he would try to catch her leaving by pretending to have left home and then lying in wait downstairs. Now, if he caught her disobeying him, he would beat her. And he even controlled what TV shows she would watch while he was gone. So he banned The Cosby Show because he didn't like African Americans. And when he came home from work, he would check the back of the TV to see if it was warm. And if it was warm, he'd check the TV guide to see what shows had been on. And if there was nothing on that he approved of, he'd beat her for watching something that wasn't approved.
Mm-hmm.
So when Milda became pregnant again in 1982, the abuse became even worse. Now, if she put off chores due to her morning sickness, she was viciously beaten. And after their daughter Angie was born, he wouldn't let any of Milda's family come by and touch the baby or hold the baby. But outside of the family, no one knew how bad things were. He could actually be quite charming and charismatic when he wanted to be.
Now, when he was younger, maybe in Puerto Rico or when they moved to Reading, there's no prior history of domestic violence or assault. I just can't believe that he gets married. Well, he actually didn't get married. They were common law spouses. But I can't believe that that's what triggered all his rage.
I don't know. There's something with when women get pregnant that abusers can be much more vicious. It's something about feeling like they're their property at that point.
Yeah.
With these sadistic type of people. Now, as I said or I alluded to, he could be really demanding and cocky in his jobs as a musician. Like, he refused to wear the band's uniform even when he was repeatedly asked. And his abuse of Milda continued. And on one occasion, he hit her in the head with a metal bar, and she had a severe concussion, and she actually required 40 stitches in her head. So, of course, the hospital staff knew what was going on, but Milda refused to press charges. And when Milda was 9 months pregnant with their third child, Emily, he hit Milda over the head with a barbell. Can you imagine?
No.
I mean, this is really brutal. So, finally, in December of 1989, he was arrested for domestic abuse, but Milda was too afraid to file a criminal complaint, and Castro was let go. And the abuse was allowed to continue until 1996, and that's when Milda moved out of the home with her children.
Finally.
Finally.
After skull fractures.
Oh, it was so severe.
Central nervous system bleeds.
Yes. He would have eventually killed her.
He would have.
Yeah. Now, police assisted in her move, and they detained Castro, but they couldn't pursue charges because Milda wouldn't go ahead and sign the complaint. So she had 4 children from Castro. Their youngest child, Arlene, was born in 1990.
So Castro got a new job as a school bus driver. They must not, well, I guess if they did background checks back then.
Well, he'd never really been arrested for
anything. He had a clean record.
He did have a clean record.
He became a school bus driver in 1991. And he bought the house they lived in 92.
Yeah, and that's the house where the girls were eventually held captive.
Right. Some family members said that his abuse of Milda escalated after she was secluded in that house on Seymour Avenue. So things got even worse.
Yeah, because before they'd lived with family members or in apartments, so there were people around.
Mm-hmm. And he got stranger and stranger.
He did.
He put padlocks on the doors. Yeah, no one was allowed into the basement. Windows were nailed shut, later boarded up. So, and when she did finally leave, he continued to threaten and attack her. She filed a domestic violence suit in 2005, where she accused him of inflicting multiple injuries on her and of frequently abducting his daughters, because she had left by then.
Right.
She was able to get a restraining order, but it was dismissed after only a few months.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that happened.
Well, she didn't continue it.
Right.
She has to go down to the courthouse and ask for it to be continued.
Right.
So she had dropped it. She eventually did start dating and remarried, and it sounded like she married a nice guy.
It seemed like it, yeah.
Husband seemed kind to her and to her children. However, when Castro's daughters were in their teens, Castro convinced them to accuse their new stepfather of sexually abusing them.
Yeah, this was a big thing in the book that I read about how he had bought the girls' cell phones and things and gotten them to testify that they'd been touched by their stepfather. So,
yeah, they.
It certainly seems like it was coerced and that he really didn't do that.
Oh, it sure does.
Because Castro seemed really happy when the stepfather got into some trouble. That was his whole purpose of doing it.
Yeah.
He did say he would get him back.
And he did.
Yeah. So in the year 2000, Castro was set up on a blind date with this much younger woman named Lillian. And she went to watch him play gigs with his salsa band, and they began spending some nights together.
You know, it's interesting.
Yeah?
Just as I'm sitting here and thinking, Lillian's the same name as his mother.
Yes, yeah.
So you think there's some Freudian...
I do think so, because he put her on a pedestal and never beat her.
Yeah.
Weird.
And this was, he was dating her while he had the girls, or some of the girls,
yeah, later on. Yeah, later on he was.
That's just weird.
Yeah.
Anyway, I digress.
So she went to watch him play some gigs with the salsa band, and they began spending some nights together. His house was so filthy, though, according to Lillian, that she couldn't stand to stay there. She tried cleaning it, but it was just always a mess. So she had Castro come to her house whenever they would spend time together. And Lillian's family, though, they thought that Castro was a great man who treated her very well. They went to church together on Sunday mornings. And like I said, he put her on a pedestal, and they had kind of a normal, respectful sex life, according to Lillian. He was never violent or weird.
Yeah, that's strange, considering what he was doing to his captives.
Right, but she was the one. She was the one.
And I guess who wouldn't think he was okay? I mean, here's a guy who clearly idolizes their daughter.
Yeah.
And he's semi-famous as a salsa musician.
Right, and for the neighborhood, he has a nicer car, and he seems to be doing well. Yep.
Yeah, sounds like a good catch.
Yep. But Castro was actually very fascinated by sadomasochism by this time. And now that he didn't have Milda to hold captive and control, he started thinking that he needed a replacement. And because he didn't look at Lillian that way, by 2002 he made this plan, which starts this whole process of what happened.
That's the whole thing.
So, from the beginning of her life, Michelle Knight had the odds stacked against her.
And she was the first one taken by him.
Yep. Now, she was born on April 23rd, 1981, to Barbara Knight, but her father wasn't named on the birth certificate. According to Michelle's autobiography, Finding Me, her parents had identical twin sons 2 years after she was born, and some of her earliest memories are of living in a car with her mother and the two little boys. And as a small child, she wanted to be a firefighter when she grew up. She loved to watch the fire trucks go by. But she was raised in public housing and in a series of rundown houses. And when she was 5 years old, Michelle was sexually molested by a family friend. Now, the molestation continued daily until she was a teen. She missed a lot of school, and she was teased. She was called stupid because she was behind. And the one thing she had going for her that was kind of a good escape for her is that she was artistically talented. So she would draw butterflies and things kind of as escape.
Can you imagine what she went through?
I can't, no.
I mean, almost daily sexual abuse for years and years?
I really can't even imagine it, no. I mean, she really had a rough life.
I guess.
Yeah. So in November of 1994, she was 13 and she ran away from home to get away from the molestation. Can't blame her for that.
Nope. Good move.
Yeah.
Except probably not planned out.
Well, no. I mean, she didn't end up in a good place. She slept on a park bench in downtown Cleveland until she found a highway underpass, and there she slept in a trash can to keep warm. How horrible is that?
And she's 13 years old.
Yeah.
Yep. That's just terrible.
It is. Now, she survived on some church handouts until she was recruited by a local drug gang. And they put her in an apartment and paid her $300 a week as a drug runner. So that lasted for a few weeks until the dealer was arrested, and then she was back on the street. But then she was seen on the street by a friend of her father, and her father came to get her, and he dropped her at her mother's house. So she was back at her mother's house, back in the difficult situation.
Yeah. Full circle.
Yeah. So when she was 17, Michelle became pregnant. And Michelle said the father was a boy she'd had a brief relationship with. But it was also reported that her pregnancy was the result of a gang rape by three boys in a storeroom at the school. So at age 18, Michelle had a son, and she named him Joey. And soon after Joey was born, Michelle's mother brought her new boyfriend to live with them, so that was trouble. And he had a history of violence, and he was a heavy drinker.
Well, those are good elements to add to the household, aren't they?
It's just what she needed, huh?
Yeah. So apparently this new boyfriend of the mother twisted little Joey's leg when he was a toddler and broke his leg.
Yeah, I know.
Michelle took Joey to the hospital, but she was afraid to tell the truth.
Right. because she thought she'd left her child with her mother, and her mother left and left the child with her boyfriend.
Yeah, I know.
That's terrible. It's really sad.
People just think that there's some way around it or something. I don't know. It seems so easy to me, looking back. Well, Jesus, he should have reported this.
Yeah, but this is where she lives, and she didn't protect him, and she's worried. She has no support.
I know. She doesn't.
You certainly can't criticize her for that.
Oh, I'm not criticizing. I'm just thinking, damn, I wish something had been done differently.
Sure, yeah.
Anyway, she told the ER people that Joey had fallen in the park. But while he was being treated, the boyfriend's sister called the hospital and told them what had really happened. Boyfriend admitted to hurting Joey. And Joey is placed in foster care, understandably.
Yeah, yeah.
Until Michelle's home could be investigated to see if it was safe.
Right. I kind of feel like Michelle and Joey should have been put in foster care.
No kidding.
She could have used a nice home.
Sure could have.
Yeah.
So, in the meantime, Michelle moved out of her mother's house, rented a room, began looking for a job. She met and became friends with Emily Castro, who was Ariel Castro's daughter. Emily was younger than Michelle, but they got along pretty well, probably because they were intellectually about the same level.
Right, right.
Emily showed pictures of her father to Michelle and told her about him. So Michelle was familiar with Ariel, what he looked like, and what stories Emily had told her.
Yeah, it's her friend's father, so you wouldn't find that threatening.
No.
No.
You wouldn't.
So it was on Thursday, August 22nd, 2002, when this all started. Michelle had a 2:30 p.m. appointment with the Cleveland Social Services about her son, Joey. And it was in an unfamiliar part of the town for her. So a relative had agreed to take her, but then the relative canceled at 11 a.m. So Michelle's family just sucks. They let her down at every turn. Seems like, you know?
Yeah. I'm too busy to take you.
Right. So Michelle didn't have any money for a taxi, so she decided to walk there. But she was soon lost, and because the appointment time was coming up, she went into the Family Dollar store, and she wanted to call the social services office and get directions. Because she'd been asking other people directions on how to get there.
Right. How do I get there?
Right. So Castro was driving when he saw Michelle looking for directions, and he approached Michelle at the dollar store, smiling, and he told her, hey, I know the way there.
Yeah, now he doesn't know her.
No, right? He doesn't know her at all.
She knows of him.
Right.
But he doesn't know her. So, and this was just a crime of opportunity.
He was looking for someone, yeah.
Yeah, and there she was.
Yep. And she recognized him, and she said, I think I know you, and he said something like, oh, it's a small world.
Yeah.
So he said he would take her there. So he led her to his car, and when she got inside, the first sign of trouble was that she noticed there were no handles on the inside of the door. So those had been removed.
How do I get out?
Yeah. Well, you wouldn't be able to, would you?
Nope.
But then there was this small sign on the window that said puppies for sale.
Well, that's a good catch.
Yeah. We've heard that before, haven't we?
Mm-hmm. Candy and puppies.
Right. So she's making conversation with him, and she tells Castro about her fight to get custody of Joey back. And she ended up saying that Joey loved puppies. So Castro said he had to swing by his house to check up on the puppies on the way. But he reassured her that it was on the way and he'd get her to her appointment on time. So then it's 3 p.m. when they arrive at Castro's house, and Michelle said she'd wait in the car outside. But after Castro went in for a couple of minutes, he came back out and he asked her to come in. He said she should come in and choose one of the puppies for Joey. So Michelle agreed, and she went into the house, and they went in through the back door. And as they went upstairs, she wondered why she couldn't hear any puppies, any dog noises. But she saw a picture of her friend Emily on the wall, so that was kind of reassuring. And he told her, oh yeah, Emily's here, she's downstairs. And then he guided her into a small pink bedroom, and that's when he slammed and locked the door behind them, and Michelle knew that something bad had happened. She'd made a mistake getting in that truck.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
Yeah. So she screamed and begged to be let out, said she'd call the police, said she couldn't miss her appointment, so. It's sad she was still thinking about getting to her appointment and getting her son. But, you know, he wasn't smiling anymore, and he covered her nose and mouth with his hand. And he said he would kill her if she screamed again, and he threw her onto the floor where she passed out. So when Michelle came to on the floor, Castro was standing over her looking menacing. And then she noticed that, wow, the room had been prepared for this. This wasn't just some, you know, happenstance that this happened. He was preparing for this.
No, he might not have been looking specifically for her, but right. He was out trolling around looking for a victim.
Yeah, he'd actually set up two metal poles on either side of the room and with a taut cable strung between them a few feet above the floor. So the windows were actually boarded up as well. And he went out and got a stool and two big orange electrical cords. He promised her he wasn't going to hurt her and that she'd be freed soon. So he sat down on the stool and he binded her ankles, her wrists, and her neck with the cords. So her arms were behind her back, her feet were numb because they were so tightly bound. And then, I hate to even say this, but he masturbated over her. He told Michelle he really wanted to be friends with her and that he was lonely and he got kind of emotional talking to her. Really bizarre.
He's what people would call a sick fuck.
Yeah, that's a good...
Right?
It's a good diagnosis.
Yeah.
And she was crying. He punched her, and then he actually pulled out a gun and threatened her. And then he hoisted her up on the cable with the cords, kind of like with a pulley system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to keep her quiet, he stuck a dirty sock in her mouth, and he wrapped duct tape around her head and just left her there.
Right. She was there for hours that first day.
Yeah, there are varying stories. Some stories say she was there for over a day like that. Some say a few hours. But yeah, I can't even imagine.
I can't
the
imagine.
The pain, the suffering.
Yeah, no kidding. So he said to Michelle, I'm going to go get some food. Turned on a radio and left.
Yeah.
God. So the next day, Michelle's mother, Barbara, went to the police station and reported Michelle missing. Hospitals, some relatives in the morgue were checked out, and the police told Barbara that they would contact her if they found anything. Now, here's the difficulty. She was 21 years old.
Yeah.
So there's, to me, less impetus to search for an adult than for a child or a teenager.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but there's a whole controversy over whether her mother really tried hard enough. Because her mother didn't seem like the best mom ever.
Her mother sounds like a piece of shit.
And let's be frank here.
And probably didn't do much.
Yeah, well, she did report her missing in her defense. She did report her missing.
Big deal.
Yeah. So nobody was really looking for her. That's the real sad part about this.
Nobody was.
No.
So Castro came back with an Egg McMuffin. How nice of him.
Yeah.
He moved her into the basement, beat her, raped her down there in the basement.
Yeah. Now, Amanda Berry, she grew up less than 3 miles from the Castro house. She was born on April 22nd, 1986. She had a sister 2 years older named Beth. Now, when Amanda was 4, her parents split up, so she stayed in Cleveland with her mom and her sister while her father moved to Tennessee. And her father had family in Tennessee. So the girls would go visit each summer, and Amanda loved to play with her cousins in the Blue Ridge Mountains. In school, she had a reputation as a girly girl who wanted to be a fashion designer when she grew up. She loved rap music and especially Eminem. She had Eminem posters in her room.
Detroit, baby.
So at 16, Amanda got a job at Burger King, only 3 blocks from her home. And in March 2003, she started dating this cute boy named Denizo Diaz, and he was tall and handsome, and she met him at the Burger King, actually, when he was there as a customer. He drove a white Dodge convertible, and everyone called him DJ. So it was at 2 p.m. on Monday, April 21st, when Amanda kissed her mom goodbye and left for a shift at Burger King. Her 17th birthday was the very next day, and her mother had arranged a party for her. But before leaving, Amanda had put $100 in cash in her top drawer to pay for a new outfit and to get her nails done. There were also some wrapped birthday presents on her bed. So she was looking forward to this.
Absolutely.
This isn't a girl that's going to run away.
So she wasn't running away?
No.
She wasn't going to leave the money or the gifts?
No. Now, Amanda left work a half an hour early that night at 7:30 p.m., and she planned to walk home. She walked north on West 110th Street, and she was still in her Burger King uniform, carrying her big black shoulder bag. As she left the Burger King parking lot, Ariel Castro drove past her in his maroon van, and with his youngest daughter, Arlene, sitting next to him in the passenger seat. Now, Amanda thought she recognized the girl, and after Castro pulled into a driveway a little ways down and let Arlene out of the van, he made a U-turn and drove back along West 110th Street. So Amanda was talking on her cell phone with her sister, and the van pulled up beside her, and a smiling Castro asked if she needed a ride home, and Amanda said yes.
Yeah, because she knew who he was, or who she thought she knew who he was.
Yeah, and she thought the girl was in the van.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she wasn't.
No. So she said to her sister, "I gotta go, I gotta ride, I'll call you back." And she hung up her cell phone and got in the van and wasn't heard from for a very long time.
For 10 years.
Yeah. So after Amanda got into the van, that's when she realized that Arlene wasn't there. But before she could say anything, Castro introduced himself and drove off. And he asked her, "Do you know my son, Ariel Jr.? He used to work at the same Burger King. And my daughter, Angie, who's in the same school." And she did. So then she noticed that he'd driven past her house. And she asked Castro where they were going. And he said, "I'm taking you to see Angie at the house." So I don't know why she went along with that, but maybe she was just trying to be polite and get herself out of that situation. I mean, at this point, she's kind of in a bad situation.
She is, and I think she's trying to mitigate the circumstances by kind of agreeing. I mean, he says,
"Right,
yeah, we're going to go to my house and you'll see your friend, my daughter."
Yeah, and she's probably hoping to God that's true.
Yeah.
But when they arrived at the house, he invited her in to see his daughter, and he took her in the back door. And he said Angie might be in the bathroom, so he took Amanda upstairs. And they passed a closed door that had a hole in it, and Amanda saw a woman in the room, who we now know was Michelle. She asked Castro, "Who's that?" And he said it was his roommate. So then he led Amanda into the bedroom and pushed her against the wall. She screamed, and Castro pushed her down, and he raped her right there. And after he raped her, he put duct tape over her mouth, her wrists, and her ankles. Then he put a motorcycle helmet over her head.
And he took her down to the basement.
Yeah.
It just gets worse. He wrapped a large chain around her waist to a large center support pole. And then he went upstairs and locked the door. So she's stuck in this basement.
Yep.
In the dark, chained to a pole.
Can't imagine it.
She's been raped.
Yeah.
So Amanda didn't arrive home from work. Her mother knew something was wrong because her birthday was coming up and she was looking forward to it.
Right.
Amanda was always a very punctual kid, wouldn't go anywhere in a Burger King outfit or without her phone charger. And she put the money in her dresser because she was excited about her birthday party.
Yeah, so it wouldn't make any sense that she would not come home.
No. So Luana, Amanda's mom, and Beth, Amanda's sister, phoned all of Amanda's friends that evening. At 12:30 Tuesday, the day after, shortly after.
Yeah.
Luana went to the police department to report Amanda was missing, printed up flyers about her disappearance, and the police interviewed her family and friends. And in the investigation, the detectives interviewed her boyfriend, Amanda's boyfriend, DJ. She was supposed to call him the night she went missing, but she never did. He had driven all night looking for her. However, he's the prime suspect, right? You always pick on the spouse or the husband or the
boyfriend. Yeah.
So, he's the prime suspect.
Yep. Now, Castro had Amanda's cell phone, and he actually listened to the worried, pleading messages left by her family. So every day, he listened to their increasingly worried calls. And he even had erased some messages to make room for more to listen to.
It's mind-boggling.
Now, Amanda attempted to escape 2 days after her abduction, but Castro caught her and raped and beat her. and on Monday, April 28th, 1 week after her abduction. Cleveland's 10 p.m. news led off with Amanda's story. And her mother told her story and asked, you know, crying and upset, for her to be returned. So Castro actually watched this newscast. And a few minutes later, he called Luana from Amanda's cell phone. So he said to her, "I have your daughter," and he told her she's healthy and okay. But when Luana asked to speak to Amanda, he hung up. And 2 minutes later, he called back, though, and he said Mandy was going to be his wife, that she wanted to be with him, and then he hung up again. So after calling Amanda's cell phone and leaving more messages, Luana called the FBI lead investigator, and the agent said, well, this might just be a hoax, and Amanda just might be in on it.
Well, that doesn't sound real believable to me.
No, but they don't know her. And I wonder why he made those calls. Weird.
Very weird.
No, of course,
I think it's because of his personality disorder.
Yeah. Well, you know, all this happened, and this was before they could really track cell phones like they can today. So they really weren't able to do that.
They couldn't pinpoint it.
Right. So Michelle was watching the news from the room where she was chained, and she saw Amanda's story on the news. Now, she knew that Castro had done what he told her he was going to do. He said he was going to kidnap a blonde girl. And he wanted Michelle to know that there was another girl in the house. But it was actually several weeks before Michelle met Amanda. Castro brought Amanda to Michelle's room, and Amanda was wearing some boys' pajamas. And although Castro introduced Amanda as his brother's girlfriend, Michelle recognized her, of course.
Sure.
And Michelle said that she was embarrassed to be seen because she was in this filthy room filled with trash and rotten food. And, of course, there was a strong smell of urine because she wasn't allowed to use the bathroom.
Yeah.
But she said, you know, she was a little bit uplifted because Amanda smiled at her.
It's just incomprehensible.
Yeah.
The amount of abuse that Michelle in particular suffered.
Yeah, she did seem to get the worst of it, although all three of the girls had horrible abuse.
They all did, but I think Michelle bore the brunt.
Yes. Now, that October, Castro broke off his 3.5-year relationship with his girlfriend Lillian. So he was now actively planning to abduct a third girl. Now, with his full-time job, his weekend music gigs, and the kidnapped girls, he felt like he didn't have time for a traditional romantic relationship.
Jesus. Yeah. Help me.
Yeah. So one day after work, Lillian found this letter from Castro on her kitchen table, and it said that he loved her, but not enough to have a long-term relationship with her. And she was actually heartbroken. She thought he was a good guy that she was missing out on.
And I'd be saying, wow, good riddance.
Yeah. Do you want to talk now a little bit about the psychiatric evaluation they did on him?
If you want.
Sure, I think now's a good time.
I mean, when he was arrested after Amanda escaped and the other girls were found, and he was charged with, I don't know how many counts of rape and injury and stuff. It was just 700 counts or something.
I think it was over 900. But at that point, who's counting?
Who's counting?
Yeah.
So he has to have a psychiatric evaluation.
To see if he can, if he's competent to stand trial?
To see if he's competent to stand trial.
Okay.
So the psychiatric evaluation basically said there was no psychiatric diagnosis.
Okay. But what else did it say about him?
Not much.
No? Like he was normal?
Basically.
That's weird.
And that he was competent to stand trial.
Okay.
So my thinking is that this court psychiatric clinic was just to determine whether or not he was competent to stand trial. And they weren't going to delve too deeply into any other things.
Okay.
Psychiatric-wise. But there's been a lot of conjecture by psychiatrists and physicians.
Yeah, and this is fascinating. So let's talk a little bit about that.
So the thought is that Ariel Castro suffered from sadistic personality disorder, which is a pervasive pattern of cruel, demeaning, and aggressive behavior, beginning by early adulthood, and indicated by the repeated occurrence of at least four of the following things. And this fits him to a T.
Okay.
Has used physical cruelty or violence for the purpose of establishing dominance in a relationship.
Check.
Check that one. humiliates or demeans people in the presence of others.
Sure.
Has treated or disciplined someone under his or her control, usually harshly. A child, student, prisoner, or patient. Check that off.
Yeah, and we're talking about his wife.
Is amused by or takes pleasure in the psychological or physical suffering of others.
That seemed true. He did seem amused by some of the things he did.
He did. Has lied for the purpose of harming or inflicting pain on others.
Obviously.
Gets other people to do what he or she wants by frightening them.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
His first wife didn't report him.
Yeah.
Restricts the autonomy of people with whom he has a close relationship. Bingo.
Right.
So he wouldn't let his wife leave the house. He wouldn't let her watch certain shows on TV. And finally, is fascinated by violence, weapons, martial arts, injury, or torture. So I think he's at least 5 out of the 6.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe 6 for 6, but he's right up there.
Sure.
So I would say, I mean, on the one hand, there's no psychiatric diagnosis in terms of whether he's competent or not to stand trial. He is competent.
Right.
But he fits the sadistic personality disorder.
Well, yeah, what did you call him earlier?
Sick fuck.
I think that's a good diagnosis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It cuts to the core.
What about, do you think his childhood had any influence?
Well, I don't know.
I don't either.
I mean, he claims to have been abused, sexually abused as a young child.
Yeah, but we don't have any proof of that.
We don't.
No.
And I know his father wasn't the greatest role model, but I don't see any reports that he had problems in Puerto Rico or in Pennsylvania or even early enough in Cleveland when he was there. So something was going on.
Yeah.
Something was festering.
Yeah. And his brothers didn't do anything like this.
No.
So it's weird. Yeah.
Very. But okay. That's the psychiatric perspective on Ariel Castro.
Yeah.
And I think the sadistic personality disorder, he definitely has a personality disorder, right?
Yeah. So on Saturday, November 15th of that year, America's Most Wanted aired a segment on Amanda's disappearance. FBI agents said that they believed Amanda was kidnapped and that the calls to Luana were made by the kidnapper. And
that's brilliant research, isn't it?
Yeah, they came up with that's the right answer.
Yeah.
So 5 days later, Michelle Knight's name was removed from the missing persons database. And they said they did that. It had been 15 months, I guess, since Michelle had gone missing. But they couldn't reach Barbara Knight to confirm that Michelle was still missing.
Yes,
so,
see, this is the mother of the year anyway.
Yeah, she fell. Yeah, she sucked. She sucked again, didn't
yeah.
she? So, Felix De Jesus had gone to school with Ariel Castro, and they were old friends. And his 14-year-old daughter, Gina De Jesus, was also best friends with Arlene Castro, one of Castro's daughters.
Uh-oh. I'm sensing where this is going.
And they were both in the 7th grade together. So at 2:30 p.m. on April 2nd, 2004, Arlene and Gina left school together, and they were walking toward West 110th Street and Lorraine Avenue. Now, they planned to go to Gina's house and play, but Arlene needed to get permission from her mom, and that's Castro's ex-wife.
Right.
So they found a payphone, and Gina gave Arlene 50 cents to call her mother. And Arlene's mother said that Arlene couldn't go to Gina's because she'd been grounded. So Gina said it was okay, and she'd walk home, because she had given part of her bus money to Arlene, so she couldn't take the bus anymore. And at that same time, Castro arrived at the girls' school, and he was looking to pick up Arlene. So he started driving around looking for her, and after he drove past the girls, he made a U-turn. And when he made the U-turn, he saw that Arlene was walking west on Lorraine Avenue by herself, so the girls had separated. And Gina was walking east on Lorraine Avenue. So Castro, thinking this was a golden opportunity to get his third girl, he pulled up beside Gina. And he asked if she knew where Arlene was, and Gina said that Arlene was walking home. But Castro got Gina into his car by asking her to help him find Arlene. Now Gina recognized him as Arlene's father, so she wasn't too nervous about getting in the car with him.
Semi-comfortable with him.
Right. Then, when they're in the car, he asked her to come to his house and help him move a speaker.
Okay.
Yeah.
Big flag.
Yeah. So she agreed to that when he got her into the house. He attacked and raped her in the basement, leaving her chained to the pole. And Michelle and Amanda heard Gina's cries and screams as she was abused and raped in the basement. Now, when Gina didn't arrive home that day, her mother looked for her around the neighborhood, and at 5 p.m. she reported Gina missing with the police, and she gave them a picture of Gina. So Gina's only 14. She's a kid.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm noticing that he's getting younger and younger.
Well, and the thing is, he claims not to know that she was that young or that she was his friend's daughter, but we can't believe that, right?
No.
No, because he saw her with his daughter.
Yeah. He knows how old his daughter is. So, and it looks like he's going for younger and younger girls.
It does, yeah. Well, Arlene Castro was the last person to see Gina. So she was obviously interviewed by the police. And flyers were handed out and posted to help find Gina. Now, a flyer was actually posted on Castro's property. So that's creepy. That's eerie, huh?
And he said, I don't know where those girls are.
Yeah. As a friend of Felix de Jesus, Castro offered his sympathy, and he offered to help Gina's parents to find their daughter.
God.
Now, in the weeks following Gina's abduction, he did grow very paranoid, and that's when he wrote this confession. In the confession, he claimed that he planned to let the girls go, and this was found in the house only after the three girls had been recovered 9 years later. He also claimed not to know that Gina was 14. And he also claimed to have been diagnosed with a cyst in his brain that may have been responsible for this behavior. So the girls' captivity was very miserable and torturous, of course. They were locked in dark rooms, they were raped, they were regularly abused. And they also lived in fear of being killed, because Castro kept a gun on him, and he threatened them repeatedly. So they were lucky to get one meal a day, they lost a lot of weight, and they only got to shower infrequently. And they also weren't allowed to use the bathroom. They had to use these plastic toilets, and they actually weren't emptied very often. So they lived in squalor and misery, basically.
For sure. I mean, that's, again, I've said this before. I just can't comprehend the degradation that these girls suffered.
Well, that's why I say they really are survivors.
Yeah.
So even though this is all horrendous, the fact that they came out the other end is uplifting.
And for the most part are doing okay.
Seem to be, yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, in all his rapes, Michelle Knight was impregnated by Castro at least 5 times. And he had induced miscarriages each time by beating her, kicking her abdomen, hitting her with dumbbells, slamming her into walls, throwing
dumbbells.
Her down.
Not dumbbells, dumbbells.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
Dumbbells.
Yeah.
Throwing her downstairs, I mean, holy cow.
Yeah.
She also at one point had a pet dog while she was held captive. But
yeah.
He killed the dog by snapping its neck.
Right in front of her.
Because he was trying to protect Michelle right in front of her.
Isn't that horrible?
So, and she was definitely the point girl for being abused. The other two didn't have as much of a time with his abuse as she did.
Well, I guess not, but they had an awful time. I mean, there was still a huge amount of abuse, right?
No question.
He might have been the hardest on her, but
Michelle
they certainly all suffered.
Michelle was the point guard for that.
Right.
So, and then Amanda Berry got pregnant by Castro, but he didn't try to induce the abortion in her.
Right.
Because she was the favored one. So she gave birth in December 2006 in an inflatable swimming pool. Castro ordered Michelle to assist with the birth, threatening to kill her if the baby didn't survive. So, and then we have some of the opportunistic people trying to get some publicity.
Right.
So in 2004, Luana, Amanda's mother, went on the Montel Williams show to meet with a psychic. That's always helpful, right?
That's awful. I mean, that just to me, that's just people taking advantage of vulnerable people in
Isn't
a bad
it?
Spot.
At this point, Amanda had been missing for a year and a half. psychic told Luana that Amanda was dead and in water. "She's not alive, honey," the psychic told her. "You will see her in heaven on the other side."
Well, according to her friends and family, the psychic's claims really broke her heart.
Wow.
And why'd the psychic say that? To me, the psychic's just going with the most probable thing. Well, she's probably dead, so I'll just say she's dead.
Yeah. I mean, that's how they work.
Right, obviously.
They play the probabilities and say, okay, the likelihood is this kid's dead, so that's what I'm going to say.
Yeah, I'm thinking of someone with the letter B. Do you have a husband named Brian or an uncle named Bob? Oh, well, I have a grandfather.
Yeah, well, that fits. Let's
name
use
Bill.
That one.
Oh, well, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's bullshit.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
People believe that shit.
Well, I think people are in a very vulnerable state of mind usually when they go to this.
I agree. They want to believe.
Right, right.
They want to have something to hook onto.
And I just feel like there's a special place in hell for people who take advantage of that.
I agree.
Yeah. So, you know, Luana just kind of lost hope right after that of finding Amanda. And she took down a lot of the flyers. She threw away some of Amanda's stuff. But then, you know, she did kind of get herself back and continue her search. But she was really depressed. It hurt her a lot. She ended up dying from heart failure in 2006.
Now, so she was fairly young.
Well, yeah, I would imagine. Yeah. In her 40s, I would guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they said she was just a nervous wreck, chain smoking, not taking care of herself. So that's pretty sad.
Well, yeah. I mean, you've lost a child. You have no idea what's happened to them. And then you get this asshole psychic who says, oh, she's dead.
Right. Now, a year after Gina's abduction, the FBI released a sketch and a description of a male suspect. And he was described as Latino, 25 to 35 years old, 5'10" and 165 to 185 pounds, with a goatee and maybe a little thin beard. But this description and sketch was pretty close to Castro's appearance because he was 5'7", 179 pounds, and he did have a goatee.
Sounds right, but there's probably 500 other people that match that description.
Yeah. Now, he kept his victims at his mercy by making them believe that their survival depended on him. He told them that he'd taken other women, some that he'd killed and some that he'd released. And for punishments, he withheld food or water. He actually began to rape the girls in front of one another. He'd put them in the cold basement in winter so they'd be freezing. And he put them in the stifling hot attic in the summer. So the disappearances of Gina and Amanda received a lot of media attention over the years. And up until 2012, family and supporters held vigils and regular searches for the two young women. Now, Castro was actually identified by Gina's family in video footage of two of the vigils. Castro also participated in a search party, and he tried to have a close relationship with Gina's family, offering his support.
That's pretty brazen, don't you think?
Yeah. I wonder if he actually got a kick out of that, sicko.
It's almost like he's taunting them.
Like he feels like he's getting away with something.
Mm-hmm.
It's gross. So while a journalism student in 2004, Ariel Castro Jr., who has since changed his name to Anthony, interviewed Gina DeJesus' mother for an article about the two disappearances, police kept their investigations open. They offered a $25,000 reward for information as well. But because Castro considered Amanda as his wife, he was happy when she was pregnant. And during her pregnancy, he kept her away from Michelle and Gina most of the time. Toward the end of Amanda's pregnancy, Michelle said that she actually became pregnant around that time for the fourth time. But Castro starved her and beat her and hit her abdomen until she aborted that pregnancy as well. So after losing four pregnancies, Michelle was really happy to see Amanda's daughter born. And all three of the girls felt a little bit of hope with having that new life in the house. The weird thing was that Castro seemed to really love the daughter that was born to Amanda. But in the beginning, he wouldn't buy baby supplies because for the first few months, he thought that someone might become suspicious if he went and bought diapers and stuff. To clothe the baby, Amanda cut holes in Castro's socks for her arms and legs, and Amanda kept the baby girl with her in her room upstairs. So this is just all really unimaginable to me.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I just can't believe how you could live that way.
Well, you know, I read the book The Room and we went and saw that movie, which I think was more based on the J.C. Duggard case, but it's kind of the same thing. Like, how do you have a baby and raise a baby in this kind of situation? Now, Amanda kept the baby girl with her in her room, and she named her Jocelyn. And by the time Jocelyn was 4 years old, Castro was frequently taking her out to the park. He took her to his mother's house and to some of his music gigs, telling people that she was his girlfriend's daughter from a previous relationship.
Right.
Now, Jocelyn never had any medical or dental treatment, and Amanda tried to homeschool her the best she could in the dark and filthy house.
Yeah, just like that movie, The Room.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it is similar.
So they had a rule in the house, or Ariel had a rule in the house, because he ruled the house.
He had many rules.
No one could use their real names. So Michelle and the others were only allowed to call Jocelyn pretty, but they couldn't say her name.
Yeah.
Huh. So on the 8th anniversary of Amanda's disappearance, the local news broadcast a vigil outside the Burger King where she used to work. Castro made sure that Amanda watched the news on a small TV. Gina's disappearance was mentioned as well. But it turns out the two families had become close and were working together to keep their daughter's cases in the public eye. But no one was looking for Michelle.
That's so sad. Yeah.
It is. Well, part of that's because she's an adult. Part of that is because she has an even shittier household.
I think it's more the shitty household because a lot of grown women go missing and get plenty of attention.
Yeah.
You know?
Castro tormented Michelle. She was like his personal punching bag.
Yeah.
Tortured her emotionally as well as physically, telling her that no one cared for her or cared where she was. In the book she wrote after she was freed, she wrote that she thought Castro was harder on her because he hated her because he couldn't break her.
She does seem like a tough broad. I give her a lot of credit. She's a tough chick.
No wonder, no matter what he did to her, she continued to stand up to him.
She did. Yeah.
And she kept getting the shit beaten out of
her. She gave him some back talk. Yeah.
Yeah.
But she kept doing it. And
yeah.
I think that maybe her tough life beforehand, you know, in some kind of sad way, prepared her for this kind of thing. She was used to being mistreated.
Maybe not. But she was used to maltreatment.
Yes, she was.
And she can stand up to it.
Right. So in November 2011, Elsie Sintram was walking down Seymour Avenue at night when she saw a little girl looking out of an attic window at Castro's house. Now, when she got home, she told her brother, and he knew that Castro was a bachelor and lived alone. So Elsie was really shaken up by the way the girl was looking at her outside the window. So the brother went over to the house to check it out. And he saw that there was plywood on the window and bags all over the sides, so he really couldn't see into the house. So they decided to call the police, and they told them about this mysterious little girl at the house. But the police showed up a half an hour later, and they pounded on the door for a few minutes, and there was no answer. And then after they shined their flashlights in the driveway, they just drove away and left. So Elsie felt that the police really hadn't taken her call seriously. And there is a part in Michelle's book where she talks about knowing that the police were coming and looking, and then they left. So she was up there and knew that they were there, and they left without.
So who was looking out the window?
Jocelyn.
Amanda's daughter.
Yeah, that's what they think. Now, that wasn't the only thing, though. A few weeks later, a neighbor saw a naked girl wearing a dog collar in Castro's backyard.
Wow.
Yeah.
That would raise some suspicion, huh?
Well, I'm thinking because it's a bad neighborhood, that's part of the problem. In middle America, in a nice neighborhood, maybe the police would have paid a little more attention to these calls.
Well, maybe, but I would think that a naked woman with a dog collar would get noticed any place.
Right. Well, she was walking around naked, which seemed weird and a little bit creepy. And they claimed that they called the police, but no one ever came to check on the situation. Then sometime after that, some residents at a retirement home on Scranton Street, which overlooked the back of Seymour Avenue, saw three naked girls in Castro's backyard, and the girls had dog collars and chains on them, and they actually saw them being abused. And the residents called the Cleveland police, and they waited for them, but the police never showed up. And the next day, Castro erected an 8-foot fence with chicken wire, and he wrapped it in blue tarp to cover his backyard so people couldn't see in as well. So about a year later, September 2012, Castro's had parked his school bus in the emergency lane outside the school, and he left it there for several hours. So this was his 5th infraction as a bus driver. He'd really done a lot of weird things, and I can't believe he was still a bus driver.
Yeah. They keep giving him chance after chance after chance.
Yeah, right. Well, it's a union job, and I think that's part of it. They couldn't just fire him. Because prior to that, he'd left a small child alone in the bus as he went to lunch. Actually told the kid, "Lay there, bitch, I'm going out."
Now, to me, that's grounds for firing right there.
Well, of course. I don't know why he wasn't fired. And he also made this illegal, dangerous U-turn once outside the school with a bus full of children. And he'd also threatened a parent at least one time.
So he's the bus driver of the year.
Yeah, right. So he lost his job, finally, as a bus driver. You know, that was good for the kids at the school, but not so good for the women at his home, because he was depressed and more abusive. And he was home more often. So the women really had little reprieve from his physical and emotional attacks at that point.
Yeah. He's unemployed. He's got all this free time.
Yeah.
What better thing to do than to fuck with his women?
Right. But he did love Jocelyn. He began taking Jocelyn out more often. He got her a chihuahua. And when Jocelyn was 5, Jocelyn began noticing that Amanda, Michelle, and Gina were chained and locked in the house. So Jocelyn began begging Castro not to lock them up anymore. So this was becoming a bit more difficult as she grew older.
Obviously.
Because he really liked the little girl. Now, he was also fired from his salsa band a few months later. That was because after 15 years of his arrogant behavior and being late, the band was tired of it, and they hired a new bassist. So on Christmas 2012, Jocelyn had her 6th birthday. Castro threw her a party with balloons, streamers, and a big banner that said Happy Birthday, and he had Amanda and Gina decorate the party, and he left Michelle upstairs. Now, Michelle was 3 months pregnant, and Castro videotaped Jocelyn cutting her cake with Amanda beside her, and after the party, Castro pushed Michelle down the basement stairs and kicked her with his boots, trying to make her miscarry her pregnancy again.
One more time.
Yeah. So 4 days later, Michelle started bleeding, and he took her into the bathroom, and he said to her, "You better pray that that thing is dead." Michelle lost the baby again. And Castro then blamed her for the fetus's death and beat her for killing his baby.
Well, sure.
He's so sick.
Isn't he?
Yeah. I don't get it at all. I can't even wrap my head around it.
No, it's pretty incomprehensible.
Now, in February of 2013, Castro joined Facebook, and he began to spend most of his time on the computer because he's unemployed. He had alienated himself from much of the musical community, and he was looking online for new contacts. So Castro attended the 9th anniversary fundraiser to help find Gina DeJesus in April, and he was playing with the band there, actually. He began introducing Jocelyn to family members as the daughter of a girlfriend, and he told others that this was his granddaughter.
See, here's the first rule.
Yeah.
Don't tell different lies to people. You know?
Got to keep your story straight.
We've done this before.
Right.
Got to tell the same story to everybody.
That's true. So, it was just after 4 p.m. on Monday, May 6th, that Castro told Gina and Michelle that he was going to his mother's house to get dinner. And Jocelyn began running up and down the stairs, chanting, "Daddy's gone to Grandma's house." So, she ran into Amanda's room and said, "Daddy told me to stay up here with you." And Amanda wondered, is this one of his traps? But eventually, she got up the nerve and looked outside, and his car was gone. So her bedroom door wasn't locked, as it usually was, so she decided to take a chance and go downstairs. And she tried the front door, and she was absolutely amazed that it was unlocked, so she opened it.
Wow, but the outer door was locked.
Yeah, the door in front of it was chain locked. But she peered through the door's glass panel, and she saw two neighbors sitting on the front porch across the street, so she thought, this could be my chance.
Good thought.
and she managed to stick her hand through the narrow opening between the door and the frame, and she waved it around, yelling, "Help me, I'm Amanda Berry." And eventually the people stood up from the porch and started walking toward her. Now a man told her to break the glass on the door, but she punched and pounded, and it just wouldn't break. So this is when Charles Ramsey, who was eating a hamburger, approached to see what was happening. And he told her to kick out the bottom panel of the door, and he kicked it too. And after kicks from both of them, the frame started to bend, and Amanda was able to push it out with her hands. Now she crawled out, and she brought Jocelyn out, and then she ran across the street and called 911 from the neighbor's phone. And also Charles Ramsey called 911 from his cell phone. So when police arrived, there was a crowd on the porch. Jocelyn was screaming, didn't know what the hell was going on.
Oh, no kidding.
She's so confused.
What is she, 6 years old or something?
Yeah.
She must be going crazy.
Yeah. So police entered Castro's home with guns drawn, and they announced that they were the Cleveland police. And after peeking out from a slightly open bedroom door, Michelle finally entered the hallway, and she leapt into the officer's arms. And Gina ended up coming out from another room where she was hiding. And Michelle and Gina walked out of the dark house with the police, and they were all taken to the hospital. So they had escaped.
Rescued.
Yeah. Pretty amazing.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Castro was arrested that very same day, and on May 8th, he was charged with 4 counts of kidnapping and 3 counts of rape, and 2 of Castro's brothers were also taken into custody, but they were released the next day when they figured out they had nothing to do with it. Now, Castro's bail was set at $2 million per kidnapping, for a total of $8 million because you include Jocelyn in that.
Right.
And then in July, a grand jury indicted him. And this is when they brought it to a total of 977 counts. So there were 512 counts of kidnapping, 446 counts of rape, 7 counts of gross sexual imposition, 6 felonious assaults, and 3 child endangerments, and 2 aggravated murders for the fetuses.
I mean, those numbers are just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And
I mean, you get to a certain point where it doesn't matter. He's just never going to see the light of day.
Nope.
Yeah. So on July 26th of 2013, he finally pled guilty. At first, he was pleading not guilty. And at first, he was saying that, you know, it was consensual. And he was sentenced to, in August, to life in prison plus 1,000 years.
So it doesn't look like he's ever getting out.
It didn't look that way at all. And he addressed the court, and he said, you know, I'm actually a good person. I'm not a monster. And he said that most of the sex with the women was consensual, or it was for money. They would want money for it.
Give me a break.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not anywhere near what was going on.
No, but I think in his mind, he had some kind of denial, like this was some kind of weird family for him.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
He
convinced himself in some ways.
His women.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, I know.
So he was found guilty, or he pled guilty. Michelle Knight spoke in court along with family members of Gina and Amanda. Michelle said to Castro, and I quote, "You took 11 years of my life away. I spent 11 years in hell. Now your hell is just beginning. I will overcome all that has happened, but you will face hell for eternity. I will live on, you will die, a little every day as you think of the 11 years of atrocities you inflicted on us." Good talk.
Yeah, she did a good job.
So, in the aftermath, Michelle changed her name to Lily Rose.
Sure, I don't blame her.
I don't know what the Lily Rose comes from, but I can see, certainly, changing your name.
You want to start over?
Castro's house was demolished, and shortly into his sentence, Castro hung himself.
September 3rd, 2013, he hung himself with a bed sheet in his cell, and prison staff performed CPR on him, and he was taken to the Ohio State University Medical Center in Columbus. He was pronounced dead there shortly thereafter. So the cause of death was found to be suicide by hanging.
Yeah, but there's something about Erotic asphyxiation.
There you go.
Got it.
Yeah, on October 10th, the Ohio Department of Rehab and Correction released a report, and that suggested that Castro may have died accidentally from autoerotic
asphyxiation. There, I got it that time.
But they rejected that possibility, ultimately, because actually he lined up pictures of his children. It was definitely the setting of taking his own life.
It sounded like he was trying to kill himself.
This was like a shrine of his family, and there was a Bible, and yada, yada, yada. You know, what I was hearing about when he was in prison or jail, he was complaining a lot, like, oh, I can't believe that, you know, they're not giving me good food, or it's cold in the cell, I don't have clean clothes. Really just kind of ironic that he's going to complain about these small inconveniences.
After all the atrocities he visited on those girls.
Yeah, clearly he doesn't give them the same thought that he gives himself.
No.
So he just couldn't believe that he had to suffer through that. Weird.
Very.
Yeah. So on July 9th, Knight, Barry, and DeJesus broke their public silence for the first time, and they released a video statement thanking the public for their support. So there was this Cleveland Courage Fund, and that's a bank account that was set up to help the women to transition to independent life. And it collected about $1.3 million. Before Barry's disappearance, this is interesting, her grandfather promised to give her a classic Chevy Monte Carlo from the year she was born, and he kept the car the whole time, so when she was freed, he was able to give her the car.
Wow. It might have needed some work, though.
Yeah, but I think it's just a nice little thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Fernando Colon, who was the stepfather to Castro's children.
The one who was accused of sexually abusing the girls.
Yeah, he was actually found guilty of 4 counts of gross sexual assault against Arlene and Emily. But he didn't have to go to prison. He got 3 years of supervised community control. But he did have to register as a sex offender. Now, there were like 18 counts against him, but he was only found guilty of 4. But I still feel like he was set up by Castro. I really feel that way.
Castro worked on the daughters and got them to testify.
Yeah, but the daughters were still unwilling to recant their testimony, so who knows. But Milda and Fernando split up, so she isn't with him anymore. Well, she died.
Yeah, she died of a brain tumor.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we had all that stuff about the brain tumor was induced by trauma.
Which it couldn't be, but she had bleeds in her brain.
Yeah, the bleeds could cause problems, obviously.
Right.
But the brain tumor was there anyway. It wasn't from trauma.
Well, regardless of if she died from the abuse or not, he certainly made her life difficult.
She bore a lot of his problems. Let's try this again.
Okay.
She was the brunt of his punishment.
Yeah. He took a lot out on her.
He did.
Yeah.
And just like, it sounds like Michelle Knight was similar.
Sure she was, yeah. Yeah. Well, Michelle interviewed with Dr. Phil in 2014, and then Jean and Amanda were interviewed with Robin Roberts in 2015. Amanda and Gina wrote a book together called Hope, A Memoir of Survival in Cleveland. And Michelle wrote a book, Finding Me, A Decade of Darkness, A Life Reclaimed. So I'm not sure about this separation. What do you think?
But Michelle is, yeah, I mean, she's the one that bore the most of the abuse.
Yeah. So you think she resents that?
Yeah.
Although she seemed pretty open-hearted with taking care of the baby and stuff like that and trying to protect Gina, who was quite a bit younger.
Well, but that's when they were in captivity.
Right.
So, I mean, maybe it's all coming to the surface that nobody was looking that actively for her.
Yeah.
And she just feels some resentment to the other two girls that probably didn't get as much abuse as she did.
Yeah. And she did say in one interview that she was sad that when Amanda escaped, she didn't mention the other two girls, which is true. Now, I don't know if it's significant, but when she escaped and called 911, she said, I'm Amanda Barry, I'm free. She didn't say there's two other girls in the house until they asked.
But she did eventually.
She did eventually, but it didn't seem first on her mind.
Yeah, I'm going to let that slide.
Well, sure, but I wonder if Michelle might have been a little hurt by that as well.
Yeah, I think Michelle's problems stem from earlier with the lack of parental involvement.
Yeah, but she definitely was treated worse by Castro.
She sure was.
Yeah. So actually, I read the book The Lost Girls by John Glatt, and that was pretty interesting. I'd recommend that as a read if you're interested in this case.
It's a great book.
Yeah.
It's a deeply disturbing book when you hear of the abuse that these women suffered.
Yeah, but it really gives you some details on Castro's background, which we tried to touch on.
Yeah.
And the girls' backgrounds. Also, interestingly enough, there was a TV movie on Lifetime called The Cleveland Abduction that came out in May 2015. And this is interesting. Raymond Cruz starred as Castro. You know who Raymond Cruz is?
Tuco.
Tuco Salamaca from Breaking Bad.
Wow.
And when I was at work during lunch, I tried to take a look at it on YouTube just to get a little idea about the movie. And it seemed like he did a pretty good job. He plays a psycho anyway pretty well, right?
He does. And his role in Breaking Bad is just amazing.
He's sadistic in that, so.
He is.
Yeah.
He kills a guy that works for him by beating him to death.
Yeah, basically for just saying the wrong thing.
At the wrong time.
Yeah.
Yeah, he would be quite convincing as a psycho.
He was pretty convincing from what I saw. And Taryn Manning from Orange is the New Black starred as Michelle. So this movie, Cleveland Abduction, was based on Michelle's book, so it was pretty much from Michelle's point of view.
Her standpoint.
Yeah. So there were some things about Amanda and the other girl, but it was mostly about what Michelle went through.
Right.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen Orange is the New Black, so I can't relate that one.
No, but in Orange is the New Black, she kind of plays, a poor girl. She's had a rough life, so she's the kind of person that really pulls it off well.
Okay.
Yeah. So, as I said, Michelle's not in touch with the other two, but they have nothing bad to say about each other. She just feels that Michelle said that the other two are kind of reminders of what she went through with her PTSD. It's better to kind of just keep separate.
Well, I can certainly see that.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
And again, she bore the brunt.
Yeah.
She was the one. So I think there might even be a little bit of resentment there.
I don't blame her, really.
No. I wouldn't either.
No.
But still, I mean, she's the one that seemed to be more singled out.
Well, and her mom, I guess when she was found, her mom reached out to her. Michelle wouldn't talk to her. She said, fuck you guys.
Yeah, I don't think I would either.
Yeah.
She's not the mother that I would want.
No, because even if she thought Michelle ran away, when the police called to see if she was still missing, I mean, she should have been checking in with police, right?
Right.
And there was a grandchild, too, that had nothing to do with her. She didn't see her grandchild because he was adopted by the foster family.
Yeah.
So this Barbara Knight just seems pretty shitty.
She does.
Yeah. So I'm not going to lose any sleep over her.
No.
No. Anything else on this case that we missed? I know there's a lot to it.
There's a lot. I'm sure we missed a lot, but I think we got the whole overall point.
I know one thing. Do you think that he ever kidnapped or murdered anyone else? I mean, there were a couple other girls they talked about who were murdered in the area during that time period. I wonder if he could have been responsible.
Well, I don't know. I mean, his pattern wasn't murder.
No.
It was just physical punishment and imprisonment.
Right.
So I don't know. I think he would have continued looking for more people to kidnap.
You think he would have got a fourth one?
I think he would have. Although
he went a long time though after the third one,
maybe
9 years.
Maybe he thought three was enough.
Well, it did really put a cramp in his style, you know. He had cut back on working and stuff.
Yeah. The biggest thing though, I think, was the birth of Jocelyn. That's what started.
I think that put a little conflict in his mind, yeah. Because he did seem to have a thing about caring about her.
Yeah.
Because he kind of seemed to put Amanda on a pedestal because she was blonde.
Yeah, but he wanted a blonde.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And he wanted her to have the baby.
Yeah.
But he didn't want anyone else to have the baby.
Well, did he ever impregnate the Jesus kid?
No, she doesn't think she was ever pregnant, although she was raped.
Yeah.
I think she was raped less frequently.
Yeah, he spent most of his time with the the other two girls.
Seems like it. Plus, I think Michelle protected Gina a bit.
Really?
Yeah.
So she was the one that...
Because Michelle was quite a bit older. I think she tried to protect her. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Then she's a heroine.
I think she might be.
Even though she doesn't want to have too much to do with everybody. And I can see that.
I certainly don't blame her for that.
I would try to put that as far away out of my mind as I could.
Sure. Right. And I hope that she can put together a good life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Dick, how are we doing on the beer review contest?
We have a bunch.
Yeah?
I'm so happy. I got a lot of reviews.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be going through them. I've listened to them all once. I'm going to be listening to them two or more times. And probably in the next week or two, I'll announce the winner.
Yay. All right.
Maybe, probably not next week, but the week after.
Well, that's kind of slow. Why is it going to take that long?
Well, I want to make the right choice.
Okay.
I want to.
So you're going to listen to all of them again?
I'm going to definitely listen to all of them again.
Okay.
And maybe a third time for some of them.
Okay.
I'm probably going to listen to them and winnow them down and take some more and listen to them another time. But yeah, within the next couple of weeks. So by the middle of the month, we'll have a winner.
Okay.
And we'll announce it.
Yep, and then we'll send out the winnings.
And we'll play the winning review.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Okay. And the project I've been working on was putting together our brewery store, which I've kind of gotten underway.
I want a t-shirt.
Yeah.
How do I do that?
I'll show you when we're done.
Okay. But why don't you tell our fans how to do it?
Our listeners.
Our listeners.
Well, on our website, I've added a page called Shop the Brewery. The coaster, the sticker, the snifter, and t-shirts available for purchase. So if anyone wants to buy any of these items, they're available now. I'm just getting it all perfected, but it's working now.
I got to tell you, I love the t-shirts. Yeah, and I would want one of those.
Okay.
If you weren't already going to give me one.
Well, I never said that.
Well, I'm implying that.
Okay. All right. Yeah, so go to Shop the Brewery on Tigrabber and see if there's some brewery stuff you'd like to buy.
Yeah, and there's going to be more stuff added.
Yeah, there is. And also, if you go to the Team Tigrabber page, you'll see that one thing we're adding in this new year is we're going to add some premium episodes for Team Tigrabber members only. So hopefully I'll have those out by February. And these are episodes that only Team Tigrabber members will be able to listen to.
Well, I'm going to join.
You should.
I'm already on.
Did you join?
Well, yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if you joined.
I'm giving you $1,000 a month. What are you talking about?
Well, that doesn't count.
Oh, okay.
That's just expenses for running the podcast. So you haven't paid me for, you know, getting a snifter or anything.
No, that's true.
No, you might need to sign up. I know my parents signed up, and they're giving me $5 a month. So that's pretty cool.
Well, I'll get my family to do that.
Okay. All right, so make sure to listen to True Crime Brewery on Stitcher, on Google Play, on iTunes, or on iHeartRadio. We're still working on getting to 5 stars on our iTunes rating. We're at 4.5, but I swear we're right on the verge of 5.
We are.
We've gotten lots of 5 stars.
You've got to send some more 5-star reviews.
I'm thinking 10 more, and we'll have it.
Okay.
So if there's 10 of you out there that haven't done it.
Then we got to keep it up, though.
Yeah. Well, we got to keep it. We got to maintain it.
That's the easy part, right?
Right.
Because we're so good.
Right. So if you haven't done a 5-star review, please go ahead and do that. I know it's a little bit of work, but it's well worth it, and it makes us really happy. And we'll read it on one of our episodes and welcome you to the brewery.
That's right. You'll be famous.
Yeah. Well, mildly famous.
Okay.
Yeah.
Slightly.
In a small group.
Select group.
Yes, which is even more important to be selectly famous.
That's right.
That's more important than being widely famous with any old shithead.
No, I mean, anybody can do that.
Right. This is a select few really cool people.
Who want to be known as Team Tigrabber people.
Yeah, or buy a t-shirt and then you're walking around and everybody knows that you've been to the quiet end.
That's right.
Right? Okay.
That's something we could do.
What?
We could have some big contest down the road, and the winner gets an all-expenses-paid trip to the Quiet Inn to hang out with us.
That'd be cool.
wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Well, we'll work on that.
About that. Yeah, I like that idea.
Okay.
So that means we'd actually fly them to the bar?
That's right.
Wow. Well, we'll have to stop being in the hole first.
Yeah, we will. This is probably way in the future.
Right, right.
But I think it's a reasonable thing to achieve.
All right. That's awesome.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next time at the brewery.
Next time. All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
And girls.